This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
You are listening to Le Breakdown. This is Yasser Louati speaking. This podcast is offered to you by the CJL, Committee for Justice and Liberties. We are an independent human rights and civil liberties organization thanks to our donors. If you too would like to support our investigative reporting, political education and mobilization work, you can make a donation on cjl.org.
Welcome to The Breakdown. This is your host Yasser Louati coming to you straight from the Paris Southside Beaulieu. Thanks again for joining us on this new episode, and I welcome our new listeners and viewers. Again, this episode will cover racism and social justice in the West. In this case, we're going to speak yet again about what's happening in France, but also what's happening in the US. We will see what it means to be Muslim in the West, in France and America. What are the similarities, where things are different? And of course, there will be difference because of different histories and political traditions. In order to further speak of what's happening in America and also have some kind of a look over the events in France and what they could mean for Muslim minorities in the West, to address these issues and maybe see the points of, again, divergence or not, I welcome Jonathan Brown, who is a professor of Islamic civilization at the University of Georgetown. He also happens to speak French and Arabic, which also gives him really the capacity to have an American look over French events, but also to accept criticism from French speakers like myself. Jonathan Brown, welcome to you.
Well, thanks for inviting me. Although I guess I kind of invited myself on the show because I sent so much fan mail that eventually you had to...
Well, actually, what you do not know, and because you mentioned it, actually, you were on the radar for quite a long time, since, I guess, summer of 2020. And I was following, like, especially your various books on Islamic civilization. I was like, this guy needs to come and maybe, you know, speak of whatever's happening in the US, especially back then we had the Black Lives Matter marches and the mass mobilizations, which were also finding an echo throughout Europe, the UK, France, and the Netherlands. So finally you made it here. So really, I'm really happy to have you. And to start the conversation, I'm going to ask you a simple question. And I know you've been following the events in France. Taking a look at what's happening under a so-called liberal president like Emmanuel Macron, who is pushing two bills that will be the landmark accomplishments, if I can say, of the last year of his presidency. The Comprehensive Security Bill, which would strengthen the state's coercive powers, loosening checks and balances, whatever what was left of them. And of course, the Anti-Separatism Bill, which is solely targeting Muslim communities. From Washington, where you are, how do these events, or how do you relate to these events?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that, you know, in general, and I know this is something that you know, you're aware of, right? Probably it's one of the things that I really like about your, you know, your podcast and the resources you give is that you help explain this to a kind of a worldwide audience, especially Anglophone audience. But, you know, that in some ways there's this, you know, real disconnect between maybe, I think in this case, it's correct to say kind of Anglo-Saxon perspective on religion, government, or religion, society, government, society, and a more kind of maybe continental European, especially French perspective on things like public order, secularism, notion of public space. But really, you know, a debate about identity, right? And I think what's the scary part about all of this is, you know, how little in the end it is about things like terrorism and national security and things like that, and how much it is about identity. And that's the reason that's scary is because, you know, look, none of us want a situation where somebody goes and shoots people, right? None of us would want that to happen. If, you know, if I knew somebody was going to go shoot somebody, I'd call the police. If you knew someone was going to go shoot somebody, I'm sure you'd call the police, right? So none of, you know, if we could, if someone said to you, you know, we have certain measures that are going to effectively, you know, are going to keep people safe effectively, and also take into consideration civil liberties and all this stuff. I mean, that's not super controversial. But what's interesting about both in the U.S. and in France is that these gestures, these movements, these attempts to, you know, to target Muslims, very publicly target them, right? They don't follow really, you know, like in the U.S., this stuff didn't start really until, like, Donald Trump didn't come along until 2015, 2016. 9/11 happened 20 years ago, 15 years before that, right? So it's not about some responding to some clear and present danger of a terrorist threat. It's about responding to a perception in the population that Muslims are a threat to identity, right? So that people's identity is under threat, the notion of belonging is under threat, the notion of the world, of the making sense of the world they live is under threat. And then Muslims become the scapegoat for that, right? They become the other that everybody can gang up on and use to, like, you know, engage in negative integration to sort of create, how do you solve this crisis of identity? You pick someone that you're not, and then that defines who you are, right? So, you know, watching this in Europe is frightening, a little bit less so in the UK, but still in the UK, it's still present. And it has, especially since I think the migrant crisis, was that in 2015? When that wave of migrants came from the, or was that?
Not even before, that was 2011, 2012 and 13.
Yeah, but I mean that like that one summer when there was that huge wave, and that the picture of that kid who was dead on the beach, and.
Oh, that was that was later on.
Yeah. So, you know, like it's crazy to look at these especially EU countries, and see that, like, it seems like the thing that from 2010 in the United States, the thing that ended up defining the Republican Party or kind of conservatism in the US was anti-Muslim, right? So Islamophobia becomes a thing that allows the kind of right, the conservative, the Republican Party and the right to have a cohesive identity. And now it's like seeing that on a whole continent, right? It's like the whole continent of Europe is, you know, they don't agree politically, they don't agree in terms of types of government, they don't agree in terms of, you know, how loose or tight they want the EU to be. But the one thing they can agree on is that they're not Muslims, right? So, and that Muslims don't really have a place in Europe, and that's going to define kind of what Europe is. That's just my perspective. I could be wrong about this, but what's terrifying about that is because you're not just dealing with some, you know, okay, there's a terrorist threat. How do we solve this, right? It's like you're facing like a psychological mess. You're facing like a psychological meltdown on a continent-wide level. And how can you possibly expect to negotiate that? I mean, it's so intimidating and terrifying. And at that point, people they don't care what they sacrifice or what sort of hypocrisy they engage in. You know, they'll say you have to wear a mask and you can't wear a niqab. I mean, what the heck? This is ridiculous. You know, things like that. That this just have to make this statement about Muslims are not welcome.
I mean, like the niqab, the full face veil example. I mean, that's a typical example of how a law was passed just to further, you know, steer Islamophobia and make it even more mainstream. First, when France passed the ban, I think in 2010 or 2009, it happened in the midst of the global financial meltdown. So it's not like France's priorities were, you know, this, you know, crony capitalism that led to a global collapse and a questioning of how our economies function and how they are pegged to a global finance. No, the debate in France was first, Nicolas Sarkozy, back then the conservative president, set up the national platform to debate what it means to be French, the grand debate on national identity. And in the meantime, we had the controversies about the full face veil. The full face veil is actually not even an isolated event. It's like almost non-existent. as they were, you know, pushing for this measure that, you know, Muslim women wearing the full face veil are, you know, ISIS promoters and they are, you know, Al-Qaeda activists in disguise, etc. Domestic intelligence publishes a report and says, we estimate the number of women who wear it to 367 women out of a population of over 60 million. So that shows that, you know, an extremely isolated, if not non-existent event was actually, you know, turned into a national controversy that rallied the left and the right. And when the law was about to be passed, they couldn't mention we are, you know, banning it because it promotes a specific brand of Islam, which we deem to be extremist. They passed it for security reasons, because they, constitutionally wise, it couldn't have passed. So they had to frame it like, well, in the public space for security reasons, we need to see your face. And where I salute French Muslims is that as the pandemic, went out of control in early 2020 and the masks became, you know, mandatory, they refrained from saying, hey, oh, haven't you, you know, prohibited covering up your face in public and now you're asking us to do the same thing? But again, it shows you how, you know, small events that are most negligible are, you know, used to further promote Islamophobia. My other question, Jonathan, is when 9/11 hit in the US, you and I were, you know, in college, I guess, and the reaction that the US government had towards American Muslims was different from the reaction we saw in France after the January 2015 and November 2015 attacks. Where do you see the difference and where do you see similarities in terms of framing the enemy within in order to further pass extreme laws like the Patriot Act in the US and the state of emergency in France?
Yeah, I mean, I think that before answering that, I mean, I think one of the things to keep in mind, I was just thinking about this while you were talking, is that, you know, we discussed this earlier, like that, you know, that's a book by Aaron Konani, The Muslims Are Coming, which is a terrific book. If people haven't read it, there's some, you know, short essays he wrote kind of based on that. I think the book came out in 2015 or so. But, you know, his book is really, makes an excellent point, which is that in the United States, which is a country which has a very robust freedom of religion protection. I mean, I'm grateful for that. I'm really grateful for that. There's a really strong constitutional protection of freedom of religion and freedom of speech. But what was clear was that, you know, whether you're talking about the kind of right wing or left wing conservative or liberal in the United States, the only, you know, kind of conservatives were against Muslims in general, liberals were again, okay with Muslims, but the Muslims have to be depoliticized, right? So no matter what, even the people who like you, you have to be depoliticized, right? You can't be a real citizen. And I think you mentioned this, I think it was in your podcast last week or something, you know, that to exist as citizens, right? What do Muslims want? We want to exist as citizens. We want to exist as three-dimensional citizens. By the way, I'm Muslim in case anyone's listening and cares, right? I'm Muslim. So, you know, like, what do I want? I want to be able to go out and say, I like this, I don't like that. I advocate this, I advocate that. I think this, I think that, right? I wear, you know, I want to go out like any other American has a right to go out and give my opinion about policy, government, whatever, laws. And that's all I want, right? But what the Muslims have to be depoliticized, right? So they can't express political opinions unless they're saying something that's so kind of innocuous and so sort of such a bromide that it might as well not be said, right? So I think that's the similarity in between France and the US is in both cases, Muslims have to be depoliticized. But the difference with France is I get the sense that the Muslims' very existence is political, right? So in America, if you have a hijab on or a Muslim, you know, Muslim guy with a beard, or, you know, you're going to the mosque five times a day, right? This can be really understood as free practice of religion or free exercise of religion. And that's, no one's going to have a problem with that. So even the worst, not the worst Islamophobes, but even kind of Islamophobes will be like, look, okay, these people have a right to do this. Except, by the way, if there's this new line which kind of emerged during the Trump administration, which has probably gone into hibernation now, but this idea that Islam is not a religion, that it doesn't deserve protection of freedom of religions. By the way, you should get Asma Adin to come on your show and talk about this. Her book, When Islam is Not a Religion, is a very good book.
Would love to have her.
Yeah. But my point is that in America, the religious person, the woman with the hijab, the guy with the beard, right? That could be like the Amish guy with a beard or the Jewish guy with a kippah or the nun, right? Or these are all just religious person, and that person is going to be protected as a religious person. En tant que, personne religieuse, they're going to get protected, right? But the second they get political, right? In America, when you talk about politics, it's really about Israel-Palestine. That's criticizing American foreign policy, sure, but especially Israel-Palestine is like the red line that you don't cross. In order to be a good Muslim, you have to either never talk about that or you have to be very supportive of American policy toward Israel.
Well, it's... go ahead, but you know...
Yeah, so I keep talking longer and longer. I'll try and be succinct.
It's okay, because I was going to... I'll bring it back later. Go ahead.
So I think that the important thing to keep in mind is that, in both the United States and in France, the aim of the government, the aim of the system, of the establishment, is to create depoliticized Muslims. It's to depoliticize Muslims by force and to create depoliticized Muslims by structuring education and media and civil society, right? And the difference between France and the U.S. is that in France, the Muslim existence itself is political. Whereas in the U.S., the Muslim existence is not political, it's a religious expression. But political expression is political. Yeah. Okay, but I think that's it. Important distinction. But the reason I think is if you think about that, you can see that what happened after 9/11 is, and by the way, we can have a whole show criticizing George W. Bush and everything like that. But one thing that he did, which Donald Trump never did, and which was a really important thing that he did after 9/11, like maybe the 1 or 2 days after the attack, he went to the Islamic Center on Massachusetts Avenue in downtown DC, and he gave a press conference. He stood there with a bunch of Muslims. He said, Islam is a religion of peace. Muslims are not our enemy. I mean, and so he was, obviously the president, the head of the Republican Party, and, evangelical Christian, leader of evangelical Christians. And what that did is, a lot of ways, that kept a cap on Islamophobia for 8 years. Kept the cap on it in terms of public discourse, right? So in terms of what you saw in movies, what you saw in media, what would be, how political discourse functioned, how social discourse functioned. The really bad Islamophobia in America didn't come until after George W. Bush left, until around 2010. Now, what happened during his time is the American to organs of government, especially the justice system, cracked down severely on Muslim organizations. I mean, who knows how many thousands and thousands of Muslims were just deported. We don't even know who they are or what their cases are, who are not citizens, right? Who are here on visas or studying or something, they are just gone. But in terms of the number of some of the major Muslim organizations were either shut down, put under investigation, put under threat of investigation. Some of the most prominent figures in American Muslim leadership were arrested, were often on sort of trumped up charges. But there was this hammer coming down to just make it evidently clear: Muslim organizations cannot breathe freely, right? If there is even one molecule of disagreement with U.S. government policy, if there is even a molecule of 1 cent of money that goes towards anything that could be in any way be suspect, in any way, the one case, the Holy Land Foundation case, the biggest charity, Muslim charity in the U.S., Holy Land Foundation, was shut down. Its founders and directors were put in prison from between 60-70 years in prison for giving money to an organization in Gaza that the US government also gave money to. So the same Zakat committees in Gaza that the US government, that the United Nations used to give money to people in Gaza, Holy Land Foundation with money was giving to those organizations. What did the US government say? They said, oh, but you, Holy Land Foundation, you knew these were linked to Hamas. I mean, just imagine that. Imagine that you're, so Muslims can't even give money to the same organizations that everyone else is giving money to because someone can come around and say, oh, but you think, we think you knew that there's something about this organization that's linked to Hamas.
Actually, Jonathan, I mean, it went beyond organizations because, for example, when there were revelations about the NYPD surveilling Muslim communities, you know, people estimate that it began at least as early as 2002. So it actually went beyond the Holy Land Foundation and how the network of Muslim charities was targeted by the Bush administration. The other thing, though, is that don't you think that George W. Bush made his speech after 9/11 in a mosque in Washington because back then Islamophobia wasn't really such a mainstream ideology? Because if we compare with Trump, foreign policy, American foreign policy, especially towards Palestine, didn't really change, even it got worse under Trump. But under Bush, don't you think he refrained from acting like, you know, Donald Trump? Because in 2002, you know, there were still some, how can I say, some limits that, you know, any respectable politician wouldn't cross.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, the problem with this is sort of like a chicken and egg problem, right? Where, you know, did he kind of restrain himself on Islam and Muslims because Islamophobia wasn't really a thing yet? Or was Islamophobia really not a thing yet because he was restraining himself? I think that, and this, we have to go back to the late 1990s. Remember, and this is going to, you know, shock some of your listeners maybe, but Muslims in the United States got George W. Bush elected. No joke, actually, Muslims in Florida voted for George W. Bush.
I was in America back then, Jonathan. I was in Texas, and I remember people, you know, in the Muslim community, for example, in Dallas, in the DFW area, were campaigning for, because I was there as a student, and who in his right mind would do that? And people were, and I agree with you, like I saw it with my very eyes that people from the Muslim communities campaigned for him.
Now, this is a sore topic for a lot of reasons, but one of them is that, you know, a lot of African-American Muslims will say, you know, what do you mean Muslims were for Bush? Because African-American Muslims weren't. But let's like, you know, that's a whole nother discussion, right? But I mean, the fact of the matter is that certain parts of the Muslim community in the United States were definitely supportive of Bush. And they were supportive of him not because they were, you know, it was an educated decision, right? So Bush had come out very specifically and said, identified certain rights concerns that Muslims had about secret evidence, detention of people in immigration prisons. And he was, you know, this guy was, you know, going and saying, we worship the same God, we're people of faith. I mean, he had Muslim leaders in his interfaith organizations, in his faith initiative organizations. Even before 9/11, during his time in the White House, he had a lot of Muslim leaders involved in things. So, you know, I think that if there hadn't been a 9/11, the story of the Bush administration, by the way, I want to make clear, I'm not some, you know, closet Bush fan here or something. I think if someone could disagree with me and say that I'm wrong, but I mean, I'm giving you my assessment, right? I think that if there had not been a 9/11, that this Bush's, his legacy in terms of not just Muslims in the United States, but kind of religious people of faith and religious, the role of religious people in civil society would be very different, right? So Muslims would be really part of that and not something excluded from that or something suspect. So I think that we have to keep in mind that Bush came into office and his sort of default setting was actually to try and reach out and build bridges with Muslim communities in the United States as basically looking at Muslims as Republicans, right? So like Ronald Reagan allegedly, you know, legend has it, he said this about Hispanics, that they were they're Republicans. They just don't know it yet, right? So this is the stereotype. I think a lot of this has been questioned lately, but religious, family values, hardworking, conservative, right? These people are Republicans, right? So I think that the idea of the Bush administration was Muslims are Republicans, and family values, conservative, religious, and a lot of them, a lot of immigrant Muslims, small business owners, relatively economically successful. These are the people that have Republican written all over them.
But so was a lesson learned, because what you're saying right now is open or raises the question. Wasn't it or isn't it a trap for Muslims to vote for a candidate based solely on two factors, religious, morals and fiscal reasons? Because, for example, conservatives in France, they would come to the local mosque, okay, go to the mosque and see we are not like those leftists, etc. We traditional values, etc. They get the Muslim vote locally, and at the national level, they throw the very community that voted for them under the bus, saying there is a problem with radical Islam and communitarism, that Muslims are self-excluding themselves from, they're self-excluding from the rest of society. Isn't it a trap to just vote for a candidate based on those two reasons?
Well, it depends. I mean, if you say that, it may be in the U.S. and sorry, it may be in France, but I think, if you go back to, imagine, you're in the year 2000, 9/11 hasn't happened yet. And, if you're a Muslim in the United States, African-American Muslims, diverse concerns, but a lot of their concerns would probably be the same concerns of African-American non-Muslims, right? And probably not going to feel a lot of affinity for the Republican Party or feel that their interests are protected or advanced by the Republican Party. But if you think about a lot of immigrant Muslims, they'd look at the Republican Party and say, what's the downside? I mean, there wasn't a lot of talk about radical Islam that wasn't perceived as a major threat.
But so, foreign policy wise.
Okay, but there's in the US, there's no difference. I mean, back then, that was before the war on terror, right? So it was basically things like Israel-Palestine, and the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are not, the idea that there's any difference between them on Israel-Palestine, maybe that's started a little bit in the last couple of years, but go back before 2010 or 2011 or 2012, and you couldn't fit a razor blade between the two parties on that issue. So, that's a non-issue. I mean, that's a wash in both cases. So I think that the bigger point I'm trying to make is that, during the Bush era, 2000-2008, Muslim institutions were under a lot of threat from law enforcement to depoliticize them. As you said, Muslim communities under surveillance to depoliticize, right? So the idea that you go into the mosque, you can't just say what you think. You can't talk about a political issue like another person. You can't be a citizen. But that's all true. But in terms of the kind of political rhetoric in the society, you didn't see the kind of Islamophobia you saw after 2010. Then what happened after Bush leaves office 2008, almost as soon as Obama won the election, you saw the emergence of this Tea Party, essentially white nationalism. And what became clear during a lot of these Tea Party rallies, especially 2008, 2009, 2010, is that Islamophobia, fear of Muslims, this idea of radical Islamic terrorism, which Trump would talk about all the time, this became a major motivating factor, a major rallying call in the Republican Party, basically. And that when the Republican Party came back in the 2010 interim elections, right? So every 2 years, if congressional elections, they won a huge number of seats on the back of this Tea Party wave, this Tea Party fervor. And if you looked at the thread that binds together this Tea Party and the kind of Republican Party energy at that time was Islamophobia. It binds together foreign policy hawks, fiscal conservatives, cultural conservatives, evangelical Christians, right? So the thing that all of these people can agree on is they don't like Muslims. They don't want Muslims around. They see Muslims as a threat. And so that it's really that year with the 2010 elections that Republicans realized that Islamophobia, the Muslim issue, was something that you could really use to motivate voters and get them to come to the polls. And so from that point on, Obama had to contend with that, right? And that's, by the way, that's also when you start seeing this, the burgeoning of this idea that Obama is a Muslim.
Yes.
Really, like, yes. That starts to come in, like it was present even before that, but I mean, this really starts to take off. And then you saw this with Donald Trump. And what's Donald Trump got elected for a number of reasons, but you know, one of the reasons is he would say the things that all these conservative Americans, which is probably more than half the country, I don't know exactly, but it's certainly a lot of the country, he was saying the things that they thought, but that other politicians wouldn't say. Both, he would say this about things like transgender issues. He would say it about immigration, and he would say it about Muslims. Remember when the San Bernardino attack happened, those two, that couple that shot their, all those people in San Bernardino, California. That's when Donald Trump came out and said, he said he wanted a Muslim ban. You know, he said he wanted a Muslim ban. He floated the idea of a Muslim registry, registering Muslims in the US. And this was hugely popular with his supporters. So that's, so it's really during like sort of 2010 through 2016 that you see like the peak of public Islamophobia in the US. And because Obama didn't have the authority, because he wasn't a conservative, to tamp it down. And Republican leaders realized that this was their key back into office. So they weren't going to restrict it. Trump rides that into the Oval Office. And then repeatedly, it's a major theme of his presidency during the 4 years of his presidency. Now, the last thing I'll say, and then I'll shut up because you're probably like borderline comatose from me talking. But from like the beginning, I remember like one of the first things that happened in the Trump administration was the Muslim ban. And all these people went to airports, you know, regular Americans went to airports to support Muslims. I remember my wife, who wears hijab, was like walking down, you know, in the metro stations. A woman comes up and she says, "I just want you to know you're welcome here." My wife obviously was born in the United States, you know. So, but the point is that, there's also the Women's March, which happened at the same time as the inauguration. And one of the organizers was Linda Sarsour, hijab-wearing Palestinian Muslim woman, right? So like one of the, as Trump came into office, the response by this very strong, huge portion of the American population that did not like Trump, the way to show you didn't like Trump was hug a Muslim, was to come out against his Islamophobia, right? So in some ways, the weird thing about the Trump years was it was like, the people who benefited most from Trump being in office were his own cronies and then American Muslims. You know, they really, because American Muslims received a degree of sympathy and concern that had never been publicly expressed before that time.
You spoke about the attempts to depoliticize Muslims and that they are welcome as long as they don't get involved in, you know, social activism, social justice issues, etc., let alone criticize America and her policies. The one thing I saw that struck me is that oftentimes you would see the political establishment mobilize the religious establishment to do that work of depoliticization, making sure that the way Islam is taught in the mosque and even in families and in the community networks, it's always an Islam that is constrained or restricted to faith or cultural activities. You pray, you fast, help the poor, go to Mecca, etc. And oftentimes you see that many Islamic institutions, be it, you know, in America or France, and they will come to France, where they are extremely problematic and they are responsible for the rise of Islamophobia. You will see that these Islamic organizations, willingly or not, are doing that job of making sure that Muslims only view themselves as believers and that everything that falls outside of the realm of faith is just like either to be disregarded or even to be rejected. In the case of France, for example, you know, people spoke about, keep speaking of the anti-separatism bill, which I remind our audience is literally about cracking down on any form of organizing by Muslims that would allow the government to violate the famous laïcité law, which is the secular law that separates politics and religion. You know, it's a sacred and saint law in France that now the government asks to violate when it comes to Muslims, that would allow the government to get involved in Muslim charities. He spoke about coup d'etat in charities, because, and I think intelligence are not that stupid, they know what's happening. There is a generational clash emerging in communities between those who are born in France, who view themselves in France and don't feel like they owe something to the establishment, and the immigrant Muslims who are still ruling those mosques and, you know, Islamic charities, and behave like they need to keep a low profile, behave like you are very grateful, and never dare to criticize whether they are coming from the left or the right. And Macron said we need to be able to intervene in charities if those, you know, Muslim leaders are overthrown through elections. Now, among in the aftermath or in the following the anti-separatism bill, Emmanuel Macron called for a charter of imams that would regulate the public discourse of imams. Unheard of, especially in you know, since the proclamation of the Republic. Now, in that charter, it's about prohibiting imams from speaking about state Islamophobia or calling out France's military presence abroad, bringing foreign conflicts at, you know, into France or to French public debate. That means don't speak about Palestine. And on top of it, to further normalize the limits imposed by the government onto religious leaders. But the problem is, Emmanuel Macron just asked for a charter. Some Muslim leaders doubled down and they come up. The first multiple organizations got together to come up with a charter. That they accepted the idea is already beyond me. This is a secular country. The government has no business in meddling clerical affairs, and they should not have accepted it. Some of them did. Again, I learned that one of the leaders had applied for French citizenship, so he feared for his own, you know, interests. The other one, he feared deportation because he wasn't a French citizen. So that tells you, you know, the problem people, French Muslims, are facing here. But that group was, as they were drafting a charter for Macron, the Grand Mosque of Paris goes around them and offers the most radical version of the charter, and the one being used today by the government. And that charter is used as, how can I say, a benchmark. You sign it. You are not a separatist. You don't sign it. You are a separatist, and therefore you should be kept from receiving public funding, and you can even be threatened by a shutdown. How do you see that happening in America? Because the Obama years weren't exactly years of full freedom in terms of, you know, how Muslims live their faith, and meddling in clerical affairs was indeed happening on a regular basis. What's your take on that?
Yeah, there's a really good article. I'm trying to remember, it's a 2012 Stanford Law Review. I think it's called Creating Establishment Islam. I was just trying to find it on the computer, but it wasn't coming up. I can send it to you later. It's a great article. The difference here between the United States and France is that the United States is essentially the opposite, in that the United States government cannot establish any religious denomination, right? Give any, there's two interpretations. One is, you know, it can't give any funding or support or official recognition to a religious group, or it can't give, the other interpretation would be, it can't give funding, support, or recognition to one religious group and not another one, right? So either way, doing something like getting involved in shaping Muslim religious life through, like, you know, mosques or imams and things like that would be unacceptable for the U.S. government to do. But of course, that's exactly what the U.S. government did, just through indirect means. So basically, you know, and in a lot of ways, like, this is, you know, you could think about, you know, the United States like a body, and it's almost like a biological reaction to 9/11, right? So if you feel there's a threat, if certain kinds of Muslims are seen as threats, if politicized Muslims are threats, then there's all these organs of American life that can be mobilized against that are not actually the government. Media, civil society, philanthropy, universities, right? Social pressure. So what happens after sort of 9/11 is, okay, who's going to get the grant? You know, who's going to get, if you propose a grant showing that Islam is actually a religion of peace and Muslims should never, ever touch any kind of weapons, or you have a proposal which says that I'm going to show that Muslims are actually justified in fighting when they're attacked, which is going to get the funding from whatever grant-giving organization, right? So, like, who's going to be the person who's invited on CNN, the person who is sort of pushing back against things that are politically questionable, who's trying to, you know, assert their right as a citizen to have a political opinion, or the person who's going to say, oh, yeah, Muslims are awful. Like, look at these Muslims. They're bad. Muslims need to do. We should apologize more, right? So who are the people who are going to be favored in public life? And so the various kind of organs of U.S. civil, of, you know, U.S. society, of U.S. establishment, even apart from the government, and of course the government through its funding, things like education, media, things like that, is actually able to take. Yeah, it's CVE is a perfect example, right? So CVE is like the sort of final blossoming of this, which really gets developed during the Obama era. Is this idea of, you know, how do we use law enforcement and government encouragement to monitor Muslims and make sure that they're depoliticized, right? So by that time, you know, you've created a cadre of Muslims who are actually now trained to participate in this, who see financial benefit from this. I think the difference is that what in France can be done very directly through government involvement, in the United States has to be done indirectly through kind of government and establishment control.
Or relays, yeah.
Yeah.
We see today that Muslims are ever more involved in social justice issues. And at the same time, we see that there is a normalization of anti-Muslim rhetoric. In France, it's the opposite. I mean, like, we see more Muslims getting involved, but by far never enough, because there has been a tradition of keeping the mosques as places of, you know, pacification, of neutralization. I will use the 2005 uprisings in France. October 27th, Ziad and Bouna, two youngsters in the Paris suburbs, the northern suburbs, I live on the south side, they were, like, you know, running away from the police, and they were scared. And, you know, they run away from the police and they hide in an electrical transformer. And they get electrocuted and die. And the police officers, you know, they knew what was happening. They did not keep them from you know, hiding there. And even one in the radio call says, that's it, they are dead. Okay. 27th October, there are tensions, of course, people start, you know, that event becomes a point of convergence for many, and it crystallizes all of the anger that has been brewing for decades in the banlieue, what we call the hood. By the 3rd and 4th of October, of November, which means like barely 2 weeks later, the uprising becomes a national event. We have uprisings all over the country, and those events received no support from religious institutions, not in terms of imams banding with the youngsters in the streets and throwing, you know, tear gas back at the police. No, I'm saying in terms of explaining, you know, and expressing to a national audience the ills of the communities that come to their mosques. by the third and the fourth of the event becomes nationwide, and people pinpoint to the tear gassing of a mosque as the flashpoint. That's when things, you know, turned into a full-blown rebellion. One of the main Islamic institutions, back then the UOIF, Union des Organisations Islamiques de France, of the French Union of Islamic Organizations, today rebranded French Muslims, they issue a fatwa or a legal opinion saying that burning cars is unlawful. And people were extremely upset because they were like, first, you weren't there to call out the injustices we are rising up against. You weren't there to support the family of Ziyad and Buna. You weren't there to support the mosque that got tear gassed. And here you are making this statement that nobody is calling for and getting involved into this social uprising. The problem is, again, pundits from the right who call these, they are not social uprising, they are ethnic, you know, riots, and these Muslims are inherently enemies of the Republic, et cetera, et cetera. It is the Muslims against the French Republic. And I remember even the coverage of Fox News was beyond ludicrous. And people said, because you got involved by speaking of this in religious terms and calling out these events, you in effect turned a social uprising to an ethnic riot, because people said, look, even the mosque, even the Islamic Federation is involved. When I look back at what's happening in the US, you see more and more religious organizations getting involved in the BLM marches and speaking up against, in favor of social justice and demanding, you know, equal rights for all. But there are still some resistance, right? There is still some resistance by many who would call out BLM, the same way you have organizations, you know, calling out, you know, activism in the banlieue. Even myself, in the course of my work, and I keep saying that the first roadblock when you march against Islamophobia, my apologies, the first roadblock you face is the local mosque, because they will be the outsourcing partner to make sure that all this activism is shut down. Do you think this is due to a poor political education of some Muslim leaders, the absence of a theology of liberation, or that there is inherently a contradiction within Islamic currents? Some of them are conservative and tend to be with the party of law and order, while others, especially among the newer generations, are embracing these struggles for social justice.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. This is, this is probably like the key, maybe the key issue that, Muslim communities are dealing with, certainly in the United States, and I imagine elsewhere as well, because, you know, the questions you asked, is a knot that brings together a lot of the threads, or maybe even all the threads that various anxieties and questions that Muslims have about their own identity, about their place in the societies they live in. The article is Samuel Raskoff's RASCOFF, Establishing Official Islam Law and Strategy, The Loss and Strategy of Counter-Radicalization, which is in Stanford Law Review in, I think, 2012. I sent you the PDF of it.
Thank you.
So, first of all, I think we have to pause to appreciate the massive change that occurs with what you're describing in terms of kind of the rise of BLM and social justice activism in the United States and elsewhere. Right, so you go from not just Muslims. So Muslims are depoliticized after 9/11, right? So you said it, right? You can't go into a mosque in 2010 and criticize the U.S. government. You can't get up in a khutbah and say something negative about the U.S. government. I mean, the idea of it is terrifying to think about being in that position. you know, you're being surveilled. There's probably in the people in the mosque from the who are FBI moles, right? They're going to say, hey, we really start looking into this brown guy. You know, what else is he saying? Let's start, you know, pay a visit to his house next. I mean, that's terrifying. Okay. Now, if you let's recognize something else as well, which is that in the United States in general, to actively to go out in public in the media and say something like U.S. law enforcement organizations are intentionally shooting people, innocent people, this would be unspeakable on American television. This would be inadmissible in American public life. Groups like the Black Panthers, which are now being, you know, lionized in film, I think appropriately, I thought those guys are really impressive. But I mean, if you came out and said something positive about the Black Panthers in, you know, whatever year, 2000, 2010, I mean, something like that, like this was, you know, it's like you're praising terrorists basically, right? So that's in American life in general. What happens with the shooting of Michael Brown, I think it was in 2014, right? And then the viral spread of other videos of you know, one Black man after another being shot by police officers in increasingly, I mean, you can make an excuse for one, you can make an excuse for two, then you said three, four, five, six. I mean, in more and more outrageous situations, you know, guy running away from a police officer across a field, shoots him in the back for no reason, you know? You see this stuff over and over. Suddenly you start realizing, wait a second, you know, this idea that Americans had that, you know, Americans don't have, we don't have political prisoners here. We don't have, you know, we don't have police officers who shoot people here. That's in other countries. That's like, you know, we see this on the news. There's some other country where they do this. It's not in the United States. The United States is a country of justice. You know, yeah, maybe things go wrong every once in a while, but the idea of a police officer would intentionally shoot a civilian for no reason, that's unacceptable, unconceivable, inconceivable. So suddenly the inconceivable becomes conceivable. The inconceivable becomes conceivable. And if you go from, let's say, mid 2014, 2015, 2016, you get the Trump election. So suddenly, not only is it now conceivable to think about law enforcement as a source of injustice that needs to be called out, but the head of your government is now somebody that, you know, 60% of the population thinks is a grotesque, you know, kind of monster, this sort of narcissistic, immoral, awful human being, who's now going to use the government to pursue whatever, you know, sick agenda he has. So the ideas that had been previously unthinkable or unspeakable on the kind of left, extreme left of the American political spectrum were suddenly brought within the realm of reality, of being speakable, of being thinkable, because of the shock of the election of Donald Trump and of the things like Black Lives Matter. You know, enough of the population, I think, had been shocked by this. Not the whole population, obviously. So my point is that when you think about this idea, this theme we've talked about of Muslims being depoliticized, now, because society as a whole is being politicized and is able to speak in political ways on parts of the extreme left spectrum that had previously been unthinkable, Muslims are now able to talk critically about U.S. foreign policy, critically about the U.S. government, critically about the justice system, not because there's been some recognition that Muslims are victims, because there's been some recognition that there's victims overall, right? That now Muslims become one voice among other critics of this system. Okay, so I think this is really, I don't know, maybe it's just my opinion, but this is really, really, really important, because through no action of their own, right? So Muslims weren't the ones out in the streets marching at BLM protests. Muslims weren't, you know, through no action of their own, an environment had been created in which Muslims could be political people for the first time in at least 16 years, if not earlier, right? Now, so, but here's a problem, right? Which is that from 2001 to 2016, let's just use those dates, right? Muslims had been trying to convince Muslim organizations, Muslim individuals, Muslim institutions, mosques, imams, right? Had been sitting there trying to convince the US government, US law enforcement agencies that they were not a threat, that they were good citizens, that they were well-behaved, that they were just like everybody else, right? And suddenly, there's all these people in society who are going out and doing protests and criticizing the government and calling out law enforcement for being unjust and oppressive, right, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Muslims are now on the opposite side of that equation. So what you've seen, I think, since about 2015 until today is I would say, this is just my anecdotal impression, but a gradual move. At first, some Muslim imams, some activists, some young Muslims started to speak out in support of things like Black Lives Matter, wanting to start adopted the vocabulary and the ideas of social justice activism. A lot of mosque leadership and a lot of institutional leadership pushed back against that because, a lot of Muslim organizations in the U.S. are people who benefit from the United States. You know, they're wealthy immigrant Muslim communities in the suburbs who are doing well for themselves. They're part of the establishment, right? They don't want to rock the boat. Or they're people who, again, they've spent 15 years having it been beaten in their heads that they cannot be political. It's not easy to suddenly transform into a political creature, especially when you're afraid. Like, yeah, maybe these activists aren't going to get targeted, but who's to say your mosque isn't going to get targeted by the FBI if you come out in support of BLM or something? And finally, the third thing, and this is very important as a kind of final thread, is that a lot of Muslims, who are conservative people, right, in the sort of vocabulary of kind of culture and society, right? They're conservative people in terms of their values, in terms of their understanding of gender, sexuality, family life, and everything like that. They're religious people. They look at a lot of these activists and they say, wait a second, you've got your LGBT activist, your trans activist, or all these people are all marching, but I don't agree with a lot of what they seem to stand for in terms of cultural, social, religious ideas. And then I'm over here, I've got these kind of more conservative people who are condemning these protests. I kind of feel like more in common with these conservative folks. So there's I'd say there's also a strong strain in American Muslim community that doesn't want to participate or support social justice movements because they consider certain social ideas, kind of whatever you want to call it, atheistic, anarchistic ideas in those movements to be antithetical to Islam and to what Muslims believe. So I think that's been, these are all issues that have, Muslim leadership, whether mosque imams or organizations, have had to deal with as they've tried to figure out how to position themselves vis-a-vis the sort of social justice movement, the broader social justice movement. Now, some imams came out right away, very supportive. People like Omar Suleiman, who I work with a lot, I have a lot of respect for him. Someone who's done a really good job of making very clear what he believes as a Muslim, but also making it very clear that Muslims need to be on the front line against things like unjust imprisonment, police violence, things like that. Helping out people who were detained, helping out immigrants who are being separate, families that are being separated on the border. So other people like Linda Sarsour were much more involved more kind of ensconced in or embedded in things like the Women's March, which a lot of Muslims had problems with because, Women's March wouldn't let people who are pro-life speak, right? So this is a big issue in the United States, the issue of abortion. I don't know if people care about this in France or not, but I mean, the thing that the Women's March was very pro-life, or sorry, pro-choice, right? And not, and a lot of Muslims didn't feel comfortable with that. So some Muslim organizations, especially ones that came out of more like a kind of Muslim Brotherhood background, there is, just so you know, there's no actual Muslim Brotherhood organization in the United States. There's, I think in the mid-1990s, it disbanded itself. But there's organizations that kind of come out, have like, you know, come from that Muslim Brotherhood background. They, I think, were the maybe the first ones to join in like and adopt a lot of the rhetoric and language of the social justice movement. But a lot of mosques have not done so. But I think there's increasing pressure to do so, because a lot of young Muslims, you know, if you're a Muslim teenager right now, you know, let's say you're 15, 16, 17 years old, Trump came into power when you were 11, 12, you know, your teenage years were spent being called evil by conservatives and being welcomed and celebrated by progressives. And seeing people like Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib, you know, members of Congress who are very vocally Muslim, but also very vocally progressive. And those young Muslims are going to come out and expect their mosque leadership to share their feelings about that a Muslim is someone who should be progressive. And there's contradictions involved in that as well. And I think those are the issues Muslims are dealing with now.
But that contradiction is actually maybe that's what will actually further apply pressure to see the rise of a Muslim theology of liberation that would set the framework for what it means to struggle for social justice as a Muslim. And I'm going to just comment on one thing you said, then bring you back to how liberals embraced Muslims in reaction to Trump. Marching with people does not necessarily mean you embrace whatever they stand for. So, for example, I'm going to give you an example. You can sometimes find the political support from an atheist, an anarchist, who is a staunch advocate of justice, who does not care whether you believe or not to him that domination is domination and should be fought. I'm speaking of my own experience, by the way. And you can also have a staunch religious figure who is going to side with the government when it cracks down on Muslims. And one of the biggest problems, you know, French Muslims, even in the US for that matter, Muslim communities have faced, is that many of the imams turn to become informants, willingly or not, but they end up working against the very interests of their communities. Yet they pose as the protectors of the saint Muslim identity and that Islam should be upheld and I'm working for the community, etc. While at the same time, you may have people who don't share those beliefs, but in terms of standing for justice and against injustice, they are there. I'm going to come back, Jonathan, to what you said about hug a Muslim, which became a tendency under Trump and as a rejection to his policies. We all saw what happened at the DFW airport, at the O'Hare airport, and, you know, JFK, etc. Hundreds of people, like, you know, standing with, you know, Muslim travelers. Now, it was good to stand with Muslims, and that was also a statement that you reject Trump. Even when I would travel to the U.S., you know, people I work with, you know, in my day-to-day job that I would go and meet over there. Yeah, sir, by the way, you know, I'm sympathetic, blah, 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 etc. And I don't like speaking about those things anyways. But this, to me, may look suspicious, because my question, Jonathan, is how sustainable is that support of liberals towards Muslims? So now that Joe Biden is elected, if Muslims now start criticizing Joe Biden for his policies towards Muslims in general in the U.S., Muslims, you know, in the rest of the Muslim world, Palestine, Kashmir, etc. Is that support really sustainable coming from liberals, or they will be told, listen, we supported you, but now this is, pardon my language, a white-to-white conversation in which you have no place to express your opinion?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that there's two, we have to think about this at kind of on two registers. And by the way, I have to go in about 10 minutes because I have to teach class. But the first thing to keep in mind is that Biden is centrist figure. So when you probably notice this if you follow news in the United States in during the Democratic primaries to pick the Democratic nominee, you know, Bernie Sanders was doing very well, right? And he's, you know, seen as this, you know, progressive, further left than Joe Biden candidate. And a lot of Muslims, so it's interesting, you know, look at Muslim community in the United States, there was a lot of harsh words between Muslims supporting Bernie and Muslims supporting Biden, right? Okay, obviously Biden won, but here's the thing, right? It's not just about Muslims can criticize Biden because everybody can criticize Biden, right? So not just Republicans, right? There's a whole segment of the Democratic Party and even sort of outside the Democratic Party on the left that is very critical of Joe Biden for any number of things, whether foreign policy, you know, he bombed some place in Iraq recently, I can't remember, you know. Muslims, we're not even talking about Muslims, right? So there's all these, so Muslim voices can be amongst those voices. So if, let's just imagine that Biden delivered some message to Benjamin Netanyahu or to the Israeli government about how American government stands in eternal support of Israel or something like that. There'd be a lot of criticism of him. I mean, maybe not, you know, a lot in the sense of the grand scope of American political life, but I mean, you'd see a lot of expressions of this in the media that you would never have seen 10 years ago, criticizing him for that. And a Muslim could be amongst those people. And so the point is that space has been opened and Muslims can occupy that space. So in terms of, if you think about criticizing, you know, Muslims being citizens politically now, I think that is going to be very hard to reverse. So a Muslim coming out and criticizing law enforcement, a Muslim coming and criticizing surveillance of communities, a Muslim coming out and criticizing racism, a Muslim coming out and criticizing prison, you know, you name it, right? Politically, domestically, or foreign policy, Muslims are citizens now, and I don't see that changing, at least not anytime soon. However, social issues is another question, right? Right now, I haven't been following this, but I don't think there's this thing called the Equality Bill, which is being proposed in the U.S. Congress. That would basically say that essentially federal law will say that there just can be no discrimination in any way between on issues of gender, right? Including things like transgender, things like that, right? Obviously, a lot of Republicans are against this. And imagine that a Muslim were to come out and say, you know, critical of, let's say, the kind of progressive social agenda around things like LGBT issues in the Democratic Party. Or one of some cabinet secretary, I can't remember, or undersecretary who was just approved by the Congress is transgender, right? So let's say you were to not support that, something to that effect. There would be no protection for that Muslim on the left of the left half of the American political spectrum. Not from centrists like Joe Biden, not from progressives like Bernie Sanders, right? Nobody, the only people who would protect you would be conservatives. So here's the issue, right? Politically, Muslims are protected on the left. Socially, Muslims are protected on the right. How do you exist in both those spaces at the same time? I mean, is that possible? So what you see is Muslims, if they want to talk about politics, you know, by that I mean everything aside from social issues, they are very clearly going to feel at home in the kind of progressive or even centrist Democratic Party. But then they can't talk about social issues, or they have to just say, we agree with you. And you see that from a lot of Muslims now. If Muslims want to talk and take a strong stance on social issues like LGBT, gender, family, stuff like that, they are simply not going to be welcome in the Democratic Party, either its centrist or progressive wings. So that's a big, big conundrum, major conundrum right now.
Jonathan Brown, thank you very much for your appearance on the show. I take it that this will only be the first of many, because as our listeners and viewers have noticed, we barely scratched the surface. I hope that you will be back probably with another speaker soon. Ramadan is coming, so Ramadan Mubarak to all Muslims around the world. I remind our listeners and viewers that you are a professor of Islamic civilization at the University of Georgetown. You formerly headed the Bridge Initiative. You published a series of books that I'm going to give here, Misquoting Muhammad, The Challenge and Choices of Interpreting the Prophet's Legacy at One World Publications, Muhammad, A Very Short Introduction, The Canonization of Al-Bukhari and Muslim, and Islam and Slavery, among others. Jonathan, thanks again.
It was my pleasure. And it's probably just started Ramadan right now. I mean, you probably just had Maghrib, so Ramadan Mubarak.
Thank you, and to you too as well. My regards to your family. As for you, dear listeners and viewers, thanks again for joining us. This episode is over. If you think this podcast deserves your support, please make a donation on cjl.ong. That's Charlie Juliet Lima. .OscarNovemberGolf/donation. Whatever the amount, we can still use that to remain fully independent and make this project a sustainable one. As for me, this was Yasser Louati speaking to you from the Paris Southside banlieue. The struggle continues.